This message was recorded live at Lighthouse Christian Center in Puyallup, Washington, and is designed to inspire and encourage you in your Christian journey. To find out more about Lighthouse, check out our website at www.lighthousehome.org.
Thank you, Brett, and thank you all for this privilege. A little bit of personal biography. My wife, who served with me out in the tribes of New Guinea, as I will be describing at the end of this message, was Carol Joy. She went to be with the Lord 6.5 years ago. After I'd walked through my veil of sorrow, I met another Carol named Carol Joyce. And she is the Carol who is with me in ministry now. She serves the Lord with music and speaking in women's gatherings. And so when I say Carol among the Sawi, you'll know that's a different Carol. But Carol is here. Stand up, honey. Well, you just heard me introduced as a guest speaker. And this guest speaker begins this message drawing your attention to an introduction that far outweighs even the introduction of a president, a king, a head of state. The most important introduction in history was the introduction of Jesus among the Jewish people about 2,000 years ago. And who was privileged to make that most important ever introduction? A man named John the Baptist. Now, some people are so skilled in making introductions, you become intrigued to get to know the person introduced. Others are a little flat in how they do introductions. Pastor Brett, you did just fine. But I heard of a man introducing a visiting speaker somewhere years ago. Apparently thought he was obligated to pay the visiting speaker every possible compliment he could dredge. He rambled on and on, adding compliment to compliment for several minutes. At last, the visiting speaker got to speak. He began by saying, "May God forgive our brother for his exaggerations, and may he forgive me for enjoying them." But John the Baptist did not ramble in making history's most important introduction. For the purpose of that introduction, John used what must surely be regarded as the most meaningful metaphor ever used in any language. Pointing to Jesus that day, John the Baptist said, "Behold the Lamb of God who does what?" Say it with me. "Who takes away the sin of the world." That expression, Lamb of God, was so meaningful within the cultural context of the Jewish people at that time, because for centuries they'd been sacrificing oxen, goats, sheep, even doves to illustrate the need of an atonement for sin, whereby a sinner could be genuinely reconciled to an infinitely holy God without God compromising his holiness in the act of forgiving the guilty. Those who sacrificed animals through those many centuries probably thought that it was actually that animal blood that was atoning for their sin, was it? We learn in the Epistle to the Hebrews, the blood of bulls and goats does not put away sin. But that does not mean they sacrificed those animals in vain. There was a need for what could be called a cultural compass to point people forward in time to the one who would later be revealed as the sacrifice that atones for sin. So, animal sacrifice was a Hebrew cultural compass pointing forward in time to Jesus, the fulfiller of the ideal expressed. Then if you turn from John chapter 1, verse 29, my first text, to John chapter 3, verse 14, you find another example when Jesus, conversing with Nicodemus, a teacher of Jewish law, reminded Nicodemus of an event from the Exodus account 1,400 years earlier, saying, "As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up." Jesus identified that event as foreshadowing him lifted up on the cross for us. John chapter 3, Jesus made reference to the provision of the manna for the children of Israel, chapter 6, pardon me, and on that basis identified himself as the bread of life who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. As you read on through the New Testament, fellow Christian, you'll find many more examples of things that are identified by New Testament writers as foreshadowing one aspect or another of redemption later to be provided with the advent of Jesus and the redemption that came through him. Especially in the Epistle to the Hebrews, where the writer takes care to make sure you and I understand features of the construction of the tabernacle in the wilderness or the temple in Jerusalem, aspects of the sacrifices, the altars, the priesthood, were all anticipating one feature or another of redemption. I'm sure you'll agree with me. It was good of God to give the Jewish people all those foreshadowings of him. But now I invite you to ponder another question with me, and that question is, fine for them, but what about the rest of the human race? Did God take care to give only one small percentage of mankind foreshadowings of the Savior and leave the rest of mankind without that providence? Down through the centuries, those of us who have been trained to be frontier crossers with the gospel, encouraged to go out into regions of the world where the message had never been proclaimed, learn languages in which it had never been expressed, have not been encouraged by our instructors to expect to find what could be called Gentile cultural compasses waiting out there on the other side of those faraway frontiers to help us fulfill our mission, enable us to make the meaning of the gospel clear even to people hearing the message for the very first time. Apparently, our instructors just didn't think God took the time or trouble to seed the cultures of mankind at large in this preparatory way. In spite of the fact that they apparently didn't think God did that, guess what we frontier crossers have been finding and making use of down through the centuries? Gentile cultural compasses. They're out there in the world. And we've been privileged to loosen little arrows on the dials of those unique cultural compasses and see those little arrows loosened on the dials in the context of the preaching of the gospel point men and women to Jesus in ways that are poignantly meaningful to them. And often when we frontier crossers came back home for a furlough, we did not even bother to tell our instructors about the amazing things we found out there. I guess we thought it might confuse them, might not fit into their systematic theology, so we've tended to leave them in the dark. I'm asking you, would you all like me to share some secrets with you from the other side of those frontiers? Do you really want me to? Oh, you do. I just love it when people really want me to tell them what I really want to tell them. All right, you asked for it. I'm going to invite you to travel back in time with me. Fasten your seatbelts. Let me hear the clicks. Good. On the count of three. One, two, three. It's 1807. Where are we standing? Look, we're by the docks in a port city of China. Here's a ship flying a British flag. It's docking. Who's this one lone Britisher disembarking? Robert Morrison. Why is Robert setting foot in China in 1807? Oh, he's here to be a Christian missionary. Well, what do you know? Doesn't he know there's already four other ancient religions on the scene in China? They got a big head start on him. Buddhism is one. Taoism is another. Confucianism is a third. And in some areas of China, even Islam is already entrenched. What chance does one man have to establish a significant foothold for the Church of Jesus Christ in the world's most populous nation against such odds? I think he's tempted to feel discouraged. Look at the expression in his face. He's just found out that the ancestors of the Chinese 4,000 years earlier did not sit down and invent a phonetic alphabet of 26 or so symbols like our A to Z. They wanted something more complex. They got it. They invented a writing system that utilizes more than 200 little pictures that get combined in complex ways to make Chinese words. It's a pictographic writing system rather than a phonetic one like ours. And Robert Morrison is taking one look at Chinese writing, shaking his head in dismay, saying, "This reminds me of chicken tracks in the mud." He was probably tempted to complain just a little bit to God, saying, "Where were you, Lord, when they invented this? Couldn't you have exercised a little more of your marvelous capacity for sovereignty to cause them to come up with something simpler than this?" But Robert had no choice. He had to master it. He found a Chinese man who had some knowledge of English and was willing to use his rather minimal knowledge of English to help Robert Morrison crack the code of Chinese grammar and amass vocabulary. Robert was in for a surprise. Sitting down one morning with his Chinese language instructor, he gave the man his pen and said, "Please show me, which of these symbols do you use to form the word that means righteous in Chinese?" The man went swish, 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 swish on a piece of paper and showed Robert Morrison how the Chinese write the word that means righteous. Robert saw the man had drawn two symbols, placing one above the other. The upper symbol was the Chinese symbol for a sacrificial lamb. And underneath it, the symbol for first person singular pronoun. Robert realized when the Chinese write that word, they're actually writing the lamb over me, righteous. He said to his Chinese language instructor, "Sir, do you know where is the lamb under whom you and I must be found to be righteous in the sight of God?" Chinese man said, "No, I don't know where that lamb is. How about you, foreigner, do you know?" Enabling Robert Morrison to say to him, "Oh, do I have good news for you." And Robert said, "If there's one spiritually significant and coded message in this ancient writing system, there may be others. I must press on with my study, see what else is awaiting discovery here." And day after day, he found more and more of them. Eventually, 120 Chinese words, which he began to use as uniquely Chinese cultural compasses, loosening little arrows on their dials and showing Chinese people that they really point to Jesus. There were, of course, those who opposed him, calling him a foreign devil. But as more and more Chinese people paid heed to Robert, they were disarmed, saying, "Look, this man is showing us that somehow our own ancestors anticipated the teaching he would one day bring to our nation." And Chinese people began to turn to the Lord. Robert Morrison went on to translate the entire Bible into Chinese, preparing the way for eventually thousands of others who followed the trail he blazed out there. People like Hudson Taylor and Maria, and a man born up in Canada with an unusual name, Jonathan Goforth. With a name like Goforth, how could Jonathan stay home? These and eventually a few thousands saw an enormous harvest begin to be reaped in China, and the greater part of the harvest has been reaped in China since the communists took over control of China in 1949. Despite their efforts to suppress the Christian gospel, the gospel is spreading rapidly, and thousands of Chinese are becoming believers. Every month, it's estimated close to 1 million. And even secular scholars are beginning to write academic papers about what they call the Christianization of communist China. There are those who say the number of Christians is either close to 100 million or even rising to 120 million and growing. And the communists are scratching their noggins saying, "Somehow we failed to suppress this thing. What is its power?" And they've begun to show a little bit of grudging goodwill to the Christians by undoing something they did back in the 1950s. That's when they confiscated all the Christian churches, changed them into communist warehouses. They began to give some of the warehouses back to the Christians. They gladly refurbished them as churches. And so many believers and other curious people thronged to attend those reopened churches in cities of China. They've had to establish a rule for some of them, a rule that says you are not permitted to attend this church two Sundays in a row. Elsewhere in the world, pastors are frequently heard to say, "I didn't see you in church last Sunday." In China, some pastors are more likely to say, "Wait, didn't I see you in church last Sunday? What are you doing here?" Give your pastors that problem. They'll love you for it, I think. So, is it very clear that God prepared the gospel for China as well as for the Jewish people? Did he even, in an unexpected way, provide a provision for Chinese people to hear the ring of truth in an otherwise foreign-sounding message? Well, that little jaunt back in time didn't jar your bones too much, did it? Want to go a little further back? Good. Keep those seat belts fastened. On the count of three, 1, 2, 3, it's 1792. We're in India, the world's second most populous nation. That's where William Carey and his wife Dorothy are setting up housekeeping in Hindu North India. And they're experiencing very severe culture shock. Haven't been there very long when they hear a woman screaming out in the street, and they discover a Hindu custom called sati, which meant when a Hindu man died, his widow had to be burned alive on the same pile of firewood on which her husband's body was cremated. And the world's most massive system of racist apartheid called caste, C-A-S-T-E, but it's the Aryan race oppressing the Dravidian race, making them the low-caste Hindus, the lowest of the low among the Dravidians are called the Dalits. That means untouchables. People of the Dravidian race in India are worn by Hindu priests. You must take care that not even so much as your shadow touches the skin of a high caste Aryan person, because even your shadow is defiling. Didn't seem likely they could expect to find anything pointing to Jesus in that sort of a cultural context. And yet, as William Carey and others learned language after language in India, they learned a language called Sanskrit that gave them access to a body of ancient literature called the Vedas. And the oldest Vedic writings even predated Hinduism, things written more than 3,000 years ago, as much as 4,000 years ago. And these writings were purer. And they found in those most ancient Vedic writings things that read like prophecies, as if written by Job-like persons whose names are long forgotten. Here's one. Somewhere in the world, an ancient writer wrote, there's an upside-down tree. Well, what can cause a tree to be upside down? A tornado, a Hurricane Katrina, or a bulldozer? This is a tree that is upside down because it is rooted in heaven. And it grows down toward the earth instead of up from the earth. The upside-down tree spreads its branches out above the earth in every possible direction, yielding fruit for all mankind. It goes on to say the trunk of the upside-down tree will be gashed, and the sap that bleeds from the wound in the side of the upside-down tree is for the healing of mankind. Nourishing fruit from the branches, healing sap from a wound in the side. That's a very strange metaphor, don't you agree? In spite of its strangeness, does it remind you of someone you know and love? Think of the privilege of helping a Hindu in India or in Nepal, or a Hindu laboring diligently in a 7-Eleven near you, to understand the significance of that ancient metaphor from India. Well, more and more people are turning to the Lord in India. And where do you suppose the greatest response to the gospel of Jesus Christ would be? Among the Aryan Hindus on their pedestal of privilege, the high caste people, or among the Dravidians, especially the Dalits? That is where the greatest response is found. These are people who are taught by Hindu priests that they are virtually subhuman. They're learning through the gospel of Jesus Christ that they are created in whose image? In the image of God, and who cared enough for them to die to atone for their sin? God incarnate in Jesus. And they're learning by faith in him, they are invited to enjoy not some demeaning category of citizenship, but full citizenship in the most glorious kingdom that will ever be, the kingdom of God. Does that sound like good news? And they are turning to the Lord in increasing numbers. Several hundred new house churches are said to be opening their doors for the first time every month as the gospel spreads across India. And also, from time to time, a high caste person also becomes a believer. And that means that high caste person not only forfeits the privilege of being in the upper tiers of society, but tumbles down the social scale even lower than the Dalits, being defined as an outcast with zero recognition. So, China and India, the world's two most populous nations, ancient cultures. Yes, but what about Stone Age tribes hidden away in remote jungles? Especially if they're cannibals that kill people and eat their flesh, cut off heads and save skulls as trophies. You couldn't expect to find anything in that sort of a culture that could be identified as pointing forward in time to Jesus, could you? Or could you? In 1962, my first wife, Carol Joy, and I, with our baby son, Stephen, less than a year old, sailed across the Pacific Ocean to Australia, disembarked and turned right, took a flight up to New Guinea, that huge dinosaur-shaped island between Australia and the equator. New Guinea is the home of 1,000 tribes speaking 1,000 languages. That means almost one out of every 7 languages spoken on Earth is spoken there. And we went there not under CNMA, but we sure made a lot of friends of CNMA folks when we got there. But Carol and I went there under a mission called World Team. Please, everyone, say World Team. Now, please say worldteam.org. Look us up on the web. We began back in the 1870s, and there's links between World Team and CNMA because the granddaughter of the founder of World Team married A.B. Simpson. That was his wife, Margaret. Oh, and A.B. Simpson was born in Prince Edward Island, Canada, just a few miles from where I was born, but much later than him, of course. So, these are some of the tie-ins. But when we arrived, all our world teamers were up in the mountains, laboring in the midst of a tribe known as the Danis. And the Danis were already responding to the gospel. And the missionaries who got there ahead of us said, Don and Carol, you're welcome to join us in this work. There's a lot to be done. But we do need to let you know there is another option. Another tribe has been discovered not in the mountains where there's no malaria, where you can grow vegetables, but in the swamps, way to the south, at sea level, where there's malaria and filariasis and elephantiasis and dysentery and yaws, terrible tropical diseases. The tribe that is in the area of World Team's responsibility is believed to be called the Sawi. There's thought to be about 3,000 of them, and they're headhunters and cannibals. And they've never heard of judges, jails, policemen, or law courts. We do not know if they'll invite a missionary to dinner or to be dinner. You don't have to go to them. Someone will have to because it's our area of responsibility, but it doesn't have to be you. And as I was praying, I strongly felt the Lord leading me to go to the Sawi. But I said, Lord, my wife Carol is a pastor's daughter from Cincinnati, Ohio. She's been on a camping trip or two. But can I expect her to join me on a venture like that with a little baby, little Stephen, less than a year old? So I prayed and said, Lord, if that is your call, please give your own personal assurance to Carol that it is your will, not just her husband, wanting to go on a great adventure and dragging her along. And God did that. We agreed that God wanted us to go there. It was as if God was assuring us, I know they're cannibals. I know they're don't worry about that. I've taken care of everything. They'll welcome you. I have a ministry match made in heaven waiting for you, but you have to go among them to find it. So we said, send us to the Sawi. And they said, are you sure? We said, yes. So we went down. I left Carol and Stephen in a safe place, went in among the Sawi to test their attitudes, found out for a couple of years they'd begun to hear positive reports about tall, pale, sickly-looking beings called Tuans. That means European types. And all the reports about light-skinned people were positive, thank God. They never war with each other. They don't hurt anyone. Wherever they go, they bring medicine. They bring salt, steel tools, nylon fish line, amazing technology no one's ever heard of before. And so the buzz was, Tuans bring wonderful provisions and help. They're great. So the Sawi were saying wistfully to other tribes that live a little closer to civilization, are there any spare Tuans around? We think we'd like to welcome one. Only to have the other tribes say nastily, a Tuan live among you. Who do you think you are? They're a scarce commodity. Not enough for every tribe to have one, let alone every village, and they're choosy about where they live among and who they help. And so the Sawi people, hearing these insulting comments from other tribes that they would never be favored by the presence of one of these amazing beings, were saying among themselves, perhaps they're right. Will never be favored. But they also said, just in case, someday somewhere there's a Tuan who finds out that we live here, decides he wants to come and reside among us. If he does not allow the anti-Sawi propaganda of our enemies to turn him away from us, when we find out that Tuan has chosen us, we'll let him know in no uncertain terms we choose him. He'll be our Tuan. We'll be his tribe. Well, guess which sort of a bloke you're looking at here. I'm a Tuan. My wife, Carol Joy, a Nyonya, a female Tuan. Had a little baby too, on little Stephen. So when I went among them, made contact with them, they looked at me in awe. They began jabbering among themselves, and apparently they were saying, this must be one of them. And I was using gestures to indicate I wanted their help to build a little house on a little bit of high ground that might not be flooded during the monsoon season. And so they shouted for joy, took some tools I handed out, cut poles and materials for a jungle home. And when it was finished, I thanked them for helping me build it using gestures, not speaking, because I didn't know their language. And I used indications. I was going to fetch my family and would return in 3 days' time. Came back 3 days later, 10-hour journey in a wobbly dugout canoe. Came around the last bend of the river as the sun was setting, and there were 400 men, women, and children massed on the riverbank, waiting to see if the Tuan would keep his promise and come back with his family. Got closer and saw all the men had war paint on, were holding weapons. I thought, what's the meaning of the weapons and the war paint? And I didn't say anything to Carol. She probably thought they're always like that. Walked up on the shore with Stephen in my arms, leading Carol right into the midst of that armed host. They closed in all around us so tightly we could hardly move, and their eyes were gleaming with excitement, and they seemed to be waiting for a signal for something. They were. Someone shouted the signal, "Asa!" At that signal, they all began leaping in the air, brandishing their weapons, shouting for joy, pounding on their drums, began dancing around us, escorting us up to the front steps of the little house. It took us several minutes to get there. I thought, how's Carol taking this? She was smiling at the people. I thought, you know, this is just what you'd expect. And little Stephen, he used to cry if the wind caused a door to slam anywhere nearby. Here he was, nearly jumping out of my arms, reaching to grab cockatoo feathers, golden bird of paradise plumes, dog fang necklaces, pig tusk bracelets. He'd never had so many things within reach of his little hands. He was at peace too. And when we reached the little house, went inside it, closed the door, they danced around the little house all night. All the next day, all the second night, all the second day, and all the third night. Obviously, we were welcome. I had to learn their language without the help of a published grammar and without a published dictionary. And no bilingual language instructor. How do you learn a language in a situation like that? You have to resort to the finger-pointing method, which means you stand among the people and begin pointing at things, hoping they understand you, want them to give you a word in their language for whatever you point at. So I began by pointing at a man. They looked at me curiously. One of them said, "Didig." I wrote down, "Didig means man." Then I pointed at a woman, and they said, "Didig." I said, "Okay, it must mean person." Without regard to gender, crossed out man, wrote person. Then I pointed at a dog and they said, "Didig." Pointed at a house, a tree, a canoe, a paddle, a river. No matter what I pointed at, they kept saying, "Didig, didig, 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 didig." But then I was saying, "Lord, have you led me halfway around the world to learn a language that has only one word?" Finally, I realized what "didig" meant, finger. It is not solely body language to point with one finger unless you're placing a curse on someone or something. Thank God they were giving their two on the benefit of the doubt that he wasn't placing curses on them. If they'd drawn that conclusion, I wouldn't be here to tell you about it. And they were probably muttering, "This two on is so dense. He keeps holding up his finger. We keep telling the word. It just keeps asking us to repeat it. Do we have to stand here all day saying nothing but finger, 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 finger? What's the point? Are all two ons as dense as this one that we get the dumbest one that was left over?" Later, I found I had to learn to point with my lips. In our culture, you know what that's asking for. And believe me, this was just the beginning of our cross-cultural communication experience, seeking to understand the Sahui, learn their language, adapt to their world. Fast forward several months. I'd learned their language well enough to begin telling them about God, creation, the sin problem, and God's provision of a Redeemer named Jesus, born among the Jewish people long ago in a faraway place. He worked miracles, gathered disciples, and one day I narrated for a group of Sahui men the story of one of Jesus' disciples, Judas, turning against his friend and master and betraying him with a kiss to be led away and slain. Who did they think was the hero? Judas. They began applauding Judas, saying, "He's the sort of man we call a Tare Duan, the sort of man any one of us would be proud to promise a daughter to in marriage, a master of treachery." Someone else chimed in, "What Judas did to the one called Jesus, using a kiss as a means of betrayal, is what we saw we call tuiasanaman, using gestures of friendship to fatten the victim for an unsuspected slaughter." I was shocked. I sat there among them praying earnestly, "Help, Lord, I need a gift of wisdom here. You all know what the Bible says. If any man lack wisdom, let him take a further course in seminary." What does it urge first and foremost? Let him ask of God. And as we all know, God will lead the asker often to study somewhere in an excellent school. But there was no seminary professor could help me in that situation. It was as if I was up against a cultural firewall. Idealization of treachery causing the people to perceive Judas as the hero and Jesus as the dupe to be laughed at, the victim. To make things worse, Warfare was breaking out between two of three Sawi villages that moved out of the deep forest, built new villages on three sides of our little home beside the Kronkel River. And we thought we'd have just one village living as neighbors. It was great to have three villages because that many more people that Carol could treat. She eradicated a terrible skin disease called yaws, which is similar to leprosy, but easily cured. And the people were so grateful for the benefits of medicine and the provision of steel tools that we gave them when we traded with them. And so it was a win-win situation. We were helping them, and they were helping us. But two of those three villages had been at war previously, and they were unable to restrain their hatred of each other. Arrows began to fly past the windows of our home. Men were wounded outside our door. The battles went on for several months, and I kept urging them to make peace. Of course, I wanted to be a peacemaker if I possibly could. But they kept saying, "You ask us to make peace as if that should be an easy thing to do." And they even said, "You Tuans, you probably never war with each other. You may have minor disagreements, and for that, no doubt, a handshake is enough. But it isn't that way for us. You don't realize what you're asking when you say, make peace." And when I found out they honored treachery as a virtue, I said, "Aha, I think I know why it isn't easy for them to make peace, and perhaps is even impossible. Because making peace requires some basis for mutual trust. And how can that exist when each side in a conflict knows the other side's potential to use something like a peace offer as a setup for a greater slaughter?" Men and women, I actually came to the conclusion that God had called Carol and me to serve him in the midst of a culture that was devoid of any means of conflict resolution. Absence of any peacemaking mechanism. But I was wrong. I was to learn, when they said it wasn't easy, that did not mean it was impossible. There was a way. And I found out what it was when I suggested that I should move away from that cluster of three Sawi villages to another part of the same tribe where people were living at peace, so that the two villages that used to live far apart and rarely fought each other as a result would go back where they were before. It was our presence here that drew them together, and that was the cause of much more frequent conflict, much more bloodshed. So I offered to move away. And it turned out they didn't want us to go. They valued our presence. And a father in one of the two warring villages said to himself, "The Tuan and the Nyonya have chosen us, favored us by living here with us. I can't bear to see the senseless violence of my people drive them away. So I will do what is necessary for peace. If no other father will, I will." His name was Kayo. He and his wife had been married for years and were blessed with only one baby, a little baby boy about the same age as our own firstborn son, Stephen. And Kayo knew that if peace was to be made, a father had to give a son to a father in the enemy village as a peace child. The child that he gave would be raised by that family in another village. He and his wife might never see their own son again except from a distance as he grew from childhood to at least teenage years in that other village. Kayo walked down the row of longhouses of Kamur village, asking if the fathers blessed with multiple children could find the resolve to give one child as a basis of peace. He saw a lack of resolve. They all said, "No, I can't bring myself to give up my children. I love them too much." So Kayo said, "I have only one son, and I love him too. But peace has to be made." So he picked up his only child. His wife was writhing on the ground in anguish, knowing she would never get to hold her baby, little Biakadon, to her own breast again. Her husband ran with the baby in his arms out of his village, past our little home, into the middle of the enemy village with no weapons for self-defense, weaponless with his baby in his arms among enemies. They'd been shooting arrows at each other just the day before. I said to a Sawi man, He's defenseless. Will they take advantage of him? Will they kill him and the baby? And the Sawi man said, no, Don, didn't anyone tell you we Sawi never kill a man who approaches us with a baby in his arms? What was I holding in my arms when we climbed up out of the canoe 6 months earlier? Little Stephen. If they had intended to kill us that evening, little Stephen's presence in my arms would have saved our lives. Well, they were genuinely welcoming us, but even if any of them had doubts that we were coming with peaceful intent, seeing us come with a baby would have put all their doubts to rest. God timed it so that we approached the Sawi in the very most reassuring way with a baby. But Kayo carried little Byakadon in his arms, not for his own protection among enemies, not just as the equivalent of a white flag of truce, but for something much more than that. He chose an enemy father named Mahor and placed his only son in Mahor's arms and said, Mahor, I give my son, my only son, to you as a peace child. Tell me, Mahor, will you be the advocate for peace between your people and my people, at least as long as this, my peace child, remains alive in your longhouse? Mahor, honored to be chosen as the adopted father of a peace child, responded with deep emotion to Kayo, saying, Kayo, you've given an only son. This is the greatest sacrifice we've ever heard of. In living memory, a father of an only child had never made the sacrifice. Kayo took the level of sacrifice to an even higher level. The point was, if a father could bring himself to make a sacrifice as great as that, he was making a sacrifice everyone knew an insincere man could not find the resolve for, an absolute proof of trustworthiness, a basis for mutual trust in spite of a context of idealized treachery. The only way. He gave his son, and the peace was made. And they began to celebrate it. And I said, what is this, a father giving a son, an only son at that, to his enemies for the purpose of reconciliation? Why is there something familiar about this? And then it struck me like a sledgehammer of insight. With a gasp, I said, oh my God, I prayed that you would give me a gift of wisdom, and you had it prepared all along. For who knows how long this has been here in Sawi culture, waiting to be found and utilized as a cultural compass to point these people to Jesus in a meaningful way. It took me 3 months of careful study, find all the right nouns and verbs, and I began proclaiming Jesus as the Tarotim Kadon, the ultimate peace child given by Navokadon, the ultimate father, to establish the Torkon Akadon, the ultimate peace between God and man and his fellow man. Believe me, they listened with increasing interest. I was making more sense among them from that time forward than I'd made before. They began responding to my teaching with perceptive questions, including this one. Wait, Don, you're telling us now that Jesus is a peace child, but that conflicts with something you told us about him earlier. You said someone betrayed him with a kiss to be killed, didn't you? I said, yes, I did. I told you that, and I was horrified. You all acclaimed the betrayer as the hero. They said, Don, please understand something here. You did not tell us he betrayed a peace child with that kiss. If you told us that, no way would we have acclaimed him as a hero. Believe me, Judas's ratings plunged. He was the worst villain a Sawi could imagine. And Jesus was unveiled at last among them as the perfect personal fulfiller of their own uniquely Sawi peace child custom. Wasn't long before a one-eyed Sawi chief named Hato, listening to me teach, stood up, gazed at me with his one good eye, and said, Don, koni sin vakegu no hawakladadun kakein. Don, your words make my liver quiver. I said, why, Hato, my friend? He said, I've been listening to everything you've been telling us about this great peace child, Jesus, and I, Hato, am ready to lay my hand on him, kadon mani, by way of faith, as I taught them had to be done. I led him in prayer. He repeated the words after me, inviting the spirit of God's holy peace child, Jesus, to dwell within his liver, keep him in the way of peace with God and man from the inside. Yes, for the Sawi, the liver is the main thing. The heart is only a pump. And believe me, as cannibals, they know about the internal organs. Hato's life was changed. His family followed him, trusting in the Lord, and the number of Christians began to grow until there were churches established in all 18 villages that speak that beautiful language of New Guinea called Sawi. I translated the New Testament into their language and trained leaders, and now all the Sawi churches are under Sawi elder leadership. No need for a missionary. They've become educated in the Indonesian language and bearing witness to Muslims. And I wrote a book about them called Peace Child. and it's translated into 36 languages, and one of them is Indonesian. So they get their copies of their story in the Indonesian language and make sure every new government officer, every new police officer, every new school teacher comes into the area, reads it. And as they read the book, they say, what a book has been written about this godforsaken place. And the missionary who wrote it is still alive. I better not mistreat these people. They're friends of his. If I mistreat them, they'll tell him he'll write a sequel and I'll be the villain. So the Sawi are becoming well known. And when they go out and get a job somewhere, people find out one of those peace child people that we read about is here in town. Everybody wants to invite them to lunch. And they get to share their testimony. So they're witnessing for the Lord. And their numbers have more than doubled since they're no longer killing each other, no longer dying of disease the way they once did. Can you imagine how grateful Carol and I were? God did have a ministry match made in heaven waiting for us among them. And the joy was so great to see lives transformed, to see headhunters and cannibals embracing the love of God and being transformed by His grace.
We trust you are inspired and challenged by this message. For additional resources and information about Lighthouse Christian Center and its ministries, check out our website at www.lighthousehome.org or contact us at 253-848-2028. We'll be right back.